herself when she's doing practice so she can refine her art, you know. And it's very precise, very hard on the body to do what they do. And she took off, and the canopy flies open and breaks. And it was right in the middle of her very first maneuver. She didn't panic, and she got the plane on the ground safely. A year later, she published a video that I watched recently, because I have about 15,000 hours of flying time. But that's more than most pilots who fly professionally retire with. So one of the things that I wouldn't say it scares me, but I'm conscious of, is that you don't fly that many hours without an incident unless you're vigilant. So I try to stay vigilant. And so I watched her video, and she checks the canopy lever during her pre-flight and run-up and before she took off. She checks the canopy lever to see that it's closed 8 times. She published in the video, and she never closed it. She caused the accident because she never closed it. But she checked it closed 8 times. And her action was a motor response, but her brain was realizing that there's something wrong. And we call that confirmation bias in human factors engineering. You already know what the situation should be, so you convince yourself that you've done it when you actually haven't. But her brain knew something was wrong, and you could tell, and she's talking about herself, she could tell that something was wrong because she's licking her lips and she's touching her face and she's doing all these extra motions that she normally never does. It's because she knows she hasn't. Her brain knows she hasn't closed that canopy. Even though she checked it closed 8 times. Really helpful for me. It made me double down on using my checklists instead of just doing the pattern and using my memory, because I've flown so many hours. I mean, what could I possibly do wrong? You know? I mean, seriously. Confirmation bias in faith is equally as hazardous. And it can lead you down a path that will end in a wreck. So let's strip away our confirmation bias here for a minute and just and take a little journey through Exodus. We talked about the fact that the Israelites and Moses had no clue who God was. But somebody did. And they didn't miraculously just suddenly learn how to worship God and learn who he was. They had to be taught. Moses had to be taught by someone. And my proposal is that someone was Jethro. So, who's Jethro? Can we go ahead and bring that up? So, Jethro is the priest of Midian. Can we see that? Yep. This is Exodus 2:16. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and he came and he drew water at the well and filled the troughs of water for their father to water the flocks for his father. So he's the priest of Midian. Next slide. See, I got to move myself too. He lived in the wilderness of Midian. Where is the wilderness of Midian? Next slide. Okay, I wish I had a pointer. You can see where Egypt is. You can see where Midian is, way the heck over here to the east. And you see where Mount Sinai is? That is the mountain at Horeb. That is the mountain of God. That's where Moses went and saw the burning bush. That's also where the Israelites traveled to after the Exodus. He's way over here. That is the wilderness of wildernesses. Due north from where you see the Mount Sinai, it's, or let's say the D on wilderness above, that's Israel. That's the land of Israel, you know, Gaza and all that nonsense up there. That's Israel. In fact, you can see the Dead Sea at the top of the page there. But that's where, that is where Jethro lives, in the dankest, dustiest, most desolate part of the Middle East. All right, next slide. His name was Reuel, friend of God. How does a pagan priest, which is what most of us have been taught, how does a pagan priest become friend of God if he's a pagan priest? Exodus 2:8. TJ, would you help me out?
When they came home to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come home so soon today?"
So, this is a scene where where Moses had gone to the well and gotten a drink. Seven daughters come. We just read it earlier this morning. Seven daughters come to water the flocks, and Moses intervenes because other herders come in and shush them away. And Moses shushes them away, waters the flocks, and he ends up in Reuel's household. Here's a tough one. He was a Kenite. In fact, probably better to call him a Kenite than a Midianite. Did you know he was a Kenite? Well, let's find out. Judges 1:16.
And the descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up with the people of Judah from the city of Palms into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the Negev, near Arad, and they went and settled with the people.
Okay, so he's a Kenite, and not only is he a Kenite, but his son went with the Israelites after they left the land of Egypt. Did you know that? I'm not taking, by the way, this is an extra biblical text. This is just scripture. Next slide. He was a son of Abraham, not Lot. Not to discredit, but go ahead and read that one if you would, hon.
Abraham took another wife. This is after Sarah, whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimron, Jokshash, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuah.
Okay, he was a Midianite born in Abraham's family to this lady named Keturah, who was actually Sarah's handmaiden. And we probably won't go into detail because I just don't have time to cover where she came from. But here's a couple of things that we do know about her. And we'll get to, let's just go ahead and go through, because I'd like to spend some time on Abraham, but we'll come back to that here in a minute. He was a Cushite, or a Hamite. Guess what? He was a black man. Ooh, that's kind of terrifying. Yeah, one of the things that I'm most proud of in that I shouldn't say pride and prideful way, but most satisfying message I've ever given, and if you've never listened to it, go online and find it, is the one I did on racism. Because racism isn't a thing. Man didn't start identifying man by skin color until the 16th and 17th century. Everybody else was, but prior to that, mankind was defined by what? Their tribe. Okay? By tribe. Skin color and whatnot didn't mean anything. We'll get some archaeological stuff later, but one of the snapshots I did not get, I wished I could have, was some of the hieroglyphic paintings where you have, African featured people with blonde afros. Seriously, not a joke. Wouldn't that be funny if all the Aryans got their blonde hair from black people? I think that's just hysterical, but that's just me. Exodus 12:1.
Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman.
Yeah, the Cushite woman he married was was Zipporah, which was the priest of Midian's daughter. She was a Cushite woman. She's a black lady. And guess what? So was her dad. Oh, I got a second witness here. He was a cousin of Sheba. Sheba. How do we know? What do we know about Sheba, the queen of Sheba that came up from Africa and met with Solomon? He was a cousin of Sheba. Genesis 25, 1 through 4.
Now Abraham had taken another wife named Keturah, and she bore him Zimran, Jocheth, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua.
Okay, we already read that. Continue.
Jokshan was the father of Sheba and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were the Asherites, the Letushites, and the Leumites.
Good.
Awesome. The sons of Midian were Epher, Hanak, Abida, Eldaah. All were the descendants of Keturah.
All of them were the sons of descendants of Keturah, who was a black lady. Isn't that interesting? And by the way, TJ's reading this cold turkey. I'm so impressed. She's getting the names even. His sons guided the Israelites walk through the wilderness. Numbers 10, 29 through 32.
Then Moses said to Hobab, the son of Moses' father-in-law.
Okay, so Hobab was the son of Reuel,
which is Jethro.
So Jethro's son. Moses goes and begs Jethro's son. Go.
The Midianite, we are setting out for the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will treat you well, for the Lord has promised good things to Israel. I will not go, Hobab replied. Instead, I'm going back to my own land and my own people. Well, please do not leave us, Moses said, since you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you can serve as our eyes. If you come with us, we will share with you whatever good things the Lord gives us.
Any questions so far? Getting complicated? Not too bad. That's not too bad. His descendants settled in Canaan with the Israelites. 1 Samuel 15:6.
Then Saul said to the Kenites, go, depart. Go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the people of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites.
So when did the Kenites show kindness to the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt? Just when Jethro showed up with the family. Jethro showed up with the family. And Hobab went with them and showed them around, guided them. But Jethro was more than just showed up with the family. He was the teacher of Moses for 40 years in the wilderness. He taught Moses who Yehovah actually is. He was a descendant of Abraham. He came out of Abraham's family. And in fact, when he came out of Abraham's family, did Abraham teach his family how to worship Yehovah? Absolutely. Was everybody in Abraham's family circumcised? Absolutely. In fact, there's this whole scene where Zipporah saves Abraham's life by doing what? By circumcising their children. God was mad enough at Moses to kill him because Jethro had taught him better. And Moses had not. He's going in to convince the people of Israel that they need to follow this God, and he's not even following God. And his own wife has to intervene and do his job for him and circumcise the children. And Jehovah's wrath was stayed and didn't kill him. Did you ever make that connection? She knew God. She knew who her God was, and she was carrying on with the faith that she was taught by her father, who was taught by Abraham. Next slide. He teaches the Israelites, Aaron, and the rest of the elders how to worship God. Exodus 18:10 through 12.
And Jethro rejoiced over all the good things the Lord had done for Israel, whom he had rescued from the hand of the Egyptians. Jethro declared, "Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you from the land of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods, for he did this when they treated Israel with arrogance."
Okay, so this is a guy who has kept the faith his entire life, but he's never had an encounter. He's kept the faith his entire life. And after this event, this is his Peter moment. This is his profession of faith. "I've kept the faith my whole life, and now I know that Yehovah is greater than all of the gods. For he has done this and treated Israel against those people that treated him with arrogance." And then what's he do? Verse 12.
Then Moses' father-in-law Jethro brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God.
Okay, who did the sacrifice? Had I asked you before we started this study who did the sacrifice, you'd all 100% said Aaron. Right? It wasn't him. Jethro did it, and what he was doing was leading by example. He was teaching Aaron and all the elders how to properly sacrifice and worship Yehovah. This is before the Torah is even given. Now, the instructions get clear. Jethro doesn't stay with them. He goes back home. And they get the Torah, and they get clear instructions on clarification on all of this stuff. But there's been a guy in the wilderness that's been keeping the faith for all this time. He has Yah's wisdom. He has Jehovah's wisdom, and he teaches Moses to lead in Exodus 18, 19 through 22. This is, I only include this, we could skip over this, but I include it because the beginning of wisdom is fear of Yah. And Jethro was no fool, and Moses respected enough to heed his example, heed his recommendation, and do it. And it basically saved him. Go, verse 19.
"Now listen to me. I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their causes to him. Teach them the statutes and laws and show them the way to live and the work they must do. Furthermore..."
Well, now, why would he tell him to teach him the statutes and laws if he didn't know that there were statutes and laws? Okay, the Torah hasn't been given, but does Jethro know some statutes and laws? Oh, heck yeah! And he knows that Moses has got to be the priest, and he's got to know these things. All right, continue, please.
"Furthermore, select capable men from among the people, God-fearing, trustworthy men who are adverse to dishonest gain. Appoint them over the people as leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. Have these men judge the people at all times. Then they can bring you any major issue, but all minor cases they can judge on their own, so that your load may be lightened as they share it with you. If you follow this advice and God so directs you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people can go home in peace."
Verse 23 is pretty powerful. If you follow this advice, and God so directs you, he wants confirmation here. If you do that, then you will be able to endure, and all these people will go home in peace. Wow. That's Jethro, by the way. Not a pagan priest. This is a wise man. Exactly, following God. Because throughout history, Jehovah always preserves a remnant. He always preserves a remnant. And that's kind of where, depending on what we have for time today, that's where we're going to end, I hope. But This is still a work in progress, and so it's going to be, this is about as dysfunctional and disjointed as I can get, but he always preserves a remnant. If you haven't already showed the next slide, go ahead there, and then we can skip over it. But anyway, next one. There's a pattern in Scripture, and if you haven't noticed it, and this is the first time you're seeing it, then so be it, but I don't have time to go into detail. This is a 40-hour course on its own, minimum. I just completed a 12-hour course on the, and you'll hear me say it more often, on the difference between Yehovah and Elohim. And to in encompassing who Yehovah is, that tends to be used as the grace portion of God's nature, and Elohim is the justice portion of God's nature. But he's Yehovah Elohim. He's both. He's just and he's gracious. Does that make sense? So that alone was 12 hours of stuff. So this, to flesh this out, would take a very long time for you to even understand it. But in generalities, and I kind of made this stuff up on the go, on the fly, because I've never studied it in depth, but Babylon is synonymous with sin, rebellion, and separation. Children of Israel were exiled to Babylon. When Abraham was told to get up and get the heck out, he was told to get out of Babylon and go into the land I'll show you. Get away from your kindred, because they're still in Babylon, even though by that time they'd already moved up the river away from actual Babylon. But it's representative of sin, separation, and rebellion. And every time somebody rebelled, they always got shipped off to Babylon until they repented, and then they were allowed to return. Interesting. The promised land is synonymous with Eden, or living with and under the blessings of Yah. Eventually, in eternity, heaven and earth will be reunited in Eden, and there will be no separation between heavenly, the spiritual world, and the physical world. There'll be one. That's part of this whole thing that we're trying to flush out. The only ones I have time today to even do anything with are Egypt and the wilderness, because that's specific to what these parashas are covering right now. Egypt is synonymous with preservation and increase, and the wilderness is synonymous with, actually, I would rather than use preservation, I probably should have changed. I think I did change it later on I said it was more of an encounter with, that's where we encounter Yehovah. But it is synonymous with purification and testing. We'll get into more of that. But Egypt is preservation and increase. So we'll go ahead and go to the next slide. As just a few examples, and you can find many. Abraham went to Egypt during the famine, during a time of famine in Genesis 12:10.
Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe.
Okay, when Abram went into Egypt, he was a rich, 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 rich man. He'd already whooped behind on kings and had armies of his own and on and on and on. He was a wealthy dude. When he came out of Egypt, he was even wealthier, much wealthier, and it was because of the incident between Sarah and Pharaoh. If you don't remember that, go read it. He went in as a dignitary, probably one of the richest men in the world, maybe not richer than Pharaoh, but one of the richest men in the world, and by far the richest traveling Bedouin in the world. The only people that would have been richer would have been people who owned kingdoms and industry. Do I have time? Yeah. Can we switch to the photographs? I'll condense the rest of it if I have to. There was an excavation done in the 1800s where they dug up Neumotep II. He was a provincial governor in Egypt. And the provincial governors were kind of like little pharaohs. They ran the business. They ran the show for for the it was 1880 when the I think it was when the excavations were completed. And when they dug this thing up, they went into, let's see, go to yeah, you can go to the next one. Just one over. And they had immigration in Egypt at the time. There's always been immigration. You don't just cross borders. And in particular, there was immigration in Egypt, because it's written in many, many of their manuscripts that they tried to control the influx of people. In Joseph's time, they had to control the influx of people because the world was starving, and the only place that had food was Egypt. When it was a famine, the people would tend to go to Egypt and try and water their cattle in the Nile, and that was the warning that was always written. So they, about the Gaza, you know where the wall is between Egypt and Gaza, they had a garrison there that controlled the flow of people into Egypt at that point, because they didn't want them coming down the trade routes just to come down. They didn't want a bunch of homeless people sucking up all their wealth and water. Does that make sense? And if you pass muster and you were allowed into the country, you got a pass. You actually had a document that you carried around there. It was a document of safe passage. Okay? When Abraham went into Egypt, he had, go ahead and get the next slide. And he would go two more. Yeah. In this provincial governor's tomb, he had listed his resume of all of his achievements. How much goods he moved through the country every year, and how much taxes he collected. And he also kept an account of the important people he met. Like, hey man, Elon Musk and I are tight. You know, I mean, it was like, woo, I'm somebody because I knew this guy. You can't see the picture. I got it's actually a computer, it's an AI generated thing, but that actually fills this stuff in a little bit better. So we can see the photographs a little bit better. Let's just go ahead and page through them real quick. Yeah, keep going. These are some of the, go ahead and keep going past that too as well. This is some of the paintings on the wall. In fact, the picture right in the middle is of this, as part of this caravan. There's 39 people represented in the caravan. Okay, keep going. And here are some of the women in the original form. Keep going. And here, right in the middle, the lightest colored thing that looks like he's holding the horns of a antelope or something, there's a guy right in front of him, right there. We'll get to the computer rendered version of this. You can keep moving through them quickly. Keep going. Yeah, that one's the one. Go back up to that. That's excellent. Guess who that is? That's Abraham. That's a picture of Abraham. Isn't that cool? All right, and we have many, let's go ahead and skip ahead past the pictures of the tombs and stuff, so I can get a little better picture so everybody can see this. Past the picture of the tombs, where we have him and the family and everybody kind of in shot. There we go. All right, Abraham's top middle, and this is some of the other people in the crowd, okay? It dates within 2 years of Abraham's entering Canaan. Entering Egypt. This guy died 2 years afterwards. That's, even if you're a couple of decades off, that's a bullseye. That cool? And we could use scripture. We can go back and say 430 years after the event, blah, 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 do the math, and that's when this guy died. It's recorded. This was excavated in 1880, and the archaeologists that excavated it, everybody lost their mind. They go, "This is Abraham," you know, because they saw the implications here, and we'll get into some of the details. Like, for example, the clothing. neither the Canaanites or Egyptians wore that clothing. See the white robes on the right? That's the Egyptian garb. The only people that wore these multicolored outfits like this were the textile makers from, guess where? Ur of Chaldees were the textile manufacturers. And guess what Abraham was? He was from the Chaldees. So this is a Mesopotamian, this is Mesopotamian dress. And so this was a Mesopotamian dignitary, the richest man in the world. And this guy's recording the fact that he met Abraham. Now, Abraham is in the country, and all of his guys are carrying Mesopotamian and Semitic stuff with them. I'm going to hold that location when we're going to come back, that one, Jacob. But go to one of the pictures, back up a couple, where the donkey's in the picture. Pick in, that one, right there. Okay. Bottom middle, see the donkey there? And then there's a donkey on the right-hand side. Okay. Hold that. Notice they're holding spears, throwing sticks, and composite axes. There are very few people that use those, and they were Semites. It's Abraham. They were the only ones that carried those. And you wouldn't have been allowed in. He had thousands of people with him, by the way, when he came into Egypt. Because he had enough to make his own army, enough people in his that were born in his household to make his own army. You're not going to let that guy in if you think he's going to be a problem. But what Abraham is doing is he's a traitor, but more than that, he's also a mobile industrial complex. The thing above the eyeball above the Egyptian in the top right center there is what he was trading. He's trading eye paint. He's trading eye paint, and that was worth big money in Egypt. And they wanted it. And eye paint was hard to come by. You know why? Because it was made from stibium. And stibium required smelting. Required you to process it. And it required smelting. Smelting requires, it's the process of metalworking. Same process. And you need bellows and forges to do that with. Guess what are on top of those donkeys right there? Bellows for forges. He's making the stibium as he goes out of raw product, trading it to the Egyptians, and we want this guy. We want this dude here because he's bringing us stuff we want. They also had textiles that they didn't have. They're wearing them and that they were trading. Plus, he had livestock and all the other normal stuff. The thing that I find the most interesting is right above the ram's horn's head, right in front of Abraham. He's bent over holding on to the ram, right? See those symbols right there? Yeah, that. That's his name. That is his name. But the name isn't Abraham. The name is Abisha. Abisha. Okay? In Abraham's native language, Ab means father, and Ram means exalted one, means exalted. So composite, he's the exalted father. That's what Abram means. Abisha in Egyptian, Ab means father. Isha means exalted one. That's Abraham. Isn't that neat? All right. Let's go ahead and switch back. The point of doing this exercise, was that he was a smelter, and when his children, the children of Midian, became the Kenites, they were known as smiths. Their primary function in the land was as blacksmiths, as smiths, as metal processors. We'll get to the importance of that here in a minute. So where did we leave off? Egypt is a place for preservation. Okay, so we read all of that, right? Okay, let's go to the next slide, if you're there. Back one. think it is, right? We haven't read that. Yeshua was taken to Egypt to avoid death from Herod. Matthew 3, 13 through 50.
And when the Magi had gone, the angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother by night, and withdrew to Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. This fulfilled what the Lord had spoken through the prophet. "Out of Egypt I called my son."
Out of Egypt I called my son. He called two of them. Remember last time I did the message on the Exodus, Moses told Pharaoh, let my son go, my firstborn son, Israel. So out of Egypt I will call my son. All right, we're still on Egypt as preservation. But a reason I went on that sideline to so that you could see what Abraham was, everything that the Kenites knew and did, they learned from Abraham. Does that make sense? Including their ability to be metallurgists. They learned it from him. Next one. Elijah fled to the wilderness to escape. Let's go ahead and read that. I do. And he came, this is the important part. He took refuge in a cave in the mountain of Horeb, the mountain of God. Dun, dun, dun. All right, let's go ahead and read that.
So he got up and ate and drank, and strengthened by the food, he walked 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There, Elijah entered a cave and spent the night. And the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts," he replied. "But the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I'm the only one left, and they're seeking my life as well."
So he thinks he's the only one left. But as I said at the beginning of this, God always preserves a remnant. Next slide. 1 Kings 19, 11 through 13.
Then the Lord said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord. Behold, the Lord is about to pass by." And a great and mighty wind tore into the mountains and scattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, there was a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a still, small voice. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak, and he went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Suddenly, a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?"
All right, I messed up. The next slide was the piece where let's call it a precursor, a foreshadowing of the Exodus event when the children of Israel visit Mount Sinai. This is just same type of scenario. But the piece that I missed in the next slide is just the same thing over again. Apparently, in my zeal to finish this morning, I missed it. And that was that. Now I'm even losing my train of thought on that. It doesn't matter. We're moving on. I'm going to run out of time if I don't. Just read Exodus 19, 1 and 2.
In the third month, on the same day of the month that the Israelites had left the land of Egypt, they came into the wilderness of Sinai. After they had set out from Rephidim, they entered the wilderness of Sinai, and Israel camped there in front of the mountain.
Okay, so this is where they went and received the Torah. Go ahead to the next slide. And when they came out, if you saw the zoomed out view, Egypt is way up over here, and Israel is up north. Here's Mount Sinai. Most of the scholars, the Christian scholars, will draw the Exodus across the north end of the Red Sea, where it's just a puddle. It's a little tiny stream. They crossed right there in the center of the Red Sea. And in fact, archaeological studies, this is actually marked on the Sinai Peninsula. There used to be two pillars there up until the 50s or 60s where the Israelites actually crossed the Red Sea there. Everybody knew this. And so this actually under the water there, that most of the Red Sea from north to south, it's several thousand feet deep. In some places, 6,000-7,000 feet deep. That's as big as a tall mountain. Right there, the water is less than 100 feet deep. There's a natural land bridge that's under the water, but not that far under the water. And that's where they crossed. God parted the sea there, because there's no way they could have walked down 5,000 feet and 5,000 feet up. It gradually slopes off less than 100 feet, and then this land bridge goes to the other side, slopes up the other side, and there's a giant beach. You can see them. There's a beach on this side and a beach on that side, and that's where they camped. Now, they took ROVs and dives, went down there and found all of the chariot wheels and all of the bones and nonsense in that location. And that's where the Pharaoh's army ended up. So this is kind of the travels of the Israelites in the first part of the wilderness, and they end up camping at the base of Mount Sinai. Okay, let's go to the next one. Yeshua was also sent into the wilderness, Matthew 4:1-11.
Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, "If you're the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." But Jesus answered, "It's written, 'Man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God.'" Then the devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple. "If you're the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down, for it's written, 'He will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against the stone.'" And Jesus replied, "It is also written, 'Do not put the Lord your God to the test.'" Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. "All this I will give you," he said, "if you will fall down and worship me." "Away from me, Satan," Jesus told him, "for it's written, 'Worship the Lord your God and serve him only.'" Then the devil left him, and the angels came and ministered to him.
So God always sends you into a wilderness. All of his people have to go through a wilderness experience to be purified. It's a place where you go to find out who you're going to rely on, whether you're going to rely on man, yourself, or him. I feel like I'm in the wilderness right now, because this has really been, we are going through our time. And I think his remnant, the one that he's preserving for himself, is experiencing these things. Because let's face it, are the Jews the representative of God in this world right now? Is the land of Israel the representative of God in this world right now? Do they represent God? Hell no. Not even close. They reject his Messiah. Yeah, I'm talking about the real Jewish people and the nation of Israel. Do they represent God in this world? No, not even close. In fact, the highest abortion rate in the world is in Israel. Yeah. Tel Aviv is... Right, yeah. So U.S. is number two, just barely. Tel Aviv is the gay, is a homosexual capital of the Middle East. Well, of the world, actually, by percentage. No, they don't. They don't worship God. They don't acknowledge God. They got this man-made religion that they call Judaism that they observe. And other than that, they have some sort of ethical code that they abide by. But that's a whole different subject. But I'm not vilifying. I'm just saying that they are analogous to what the children of Israel were like when they were in Egypt. God found somebody else while he was prospering them and preparing them to take them into Israel, into the promised land. He preserved the faith with a remnant in the same way that he did with Elijah, in the same way that he's done all through history. We're still working on who this guy named Jethro is. Let's go to the next one. A little more archaeology. In the Middle East, in Egypt, there was one of the pharaohs that was a pharaoh after Joseph's death, but before the Exodus. And he put together a temple. It was a temple to, what's her name? Did I put it up there? The temple to Seleb, which was one of the goddesses. And in that temple, in the ruins, they found on the pillars, it's mostly just a mess. I don't have all of the slides because the PowerPoint kept crashing from the slides. Let's go to the next slide for the location. That's about Middle Egypt is where this temple was located. And it documents, as most of the Egyptians did. Go ahead and go to the next one. Most of the Egyptian pharaohs did, is it documents on the pillars that used to hold the temple up his conquests, you know, all the enemies that he conquered. Go to the next one. And the pictures, tough to see in this particular slide, but see the arms are behind their back like this? They're bound. And then on that little shield below their chest there is the identifier for who they are. It's interesting because you find the normal people. He said, I defeated the Nubians, and I defeated the Hittites, and I defeated and subjugated the Syrians. Did he actually do that to any of those people? Probably not. But he did have engagements with them, and so he counts these as victories. And one of those, let's see what slide I'm on. One of those people, yeah, it's the next one. The shield, see the arms bound? On the shield, right there at the bottom, it's tough to see. That the two panel symbol there? Okay, concentrate on that, because that's one of the slides I wasn't able to get to load. These people are identified as the Shatsu of Jehovah. Everybody else is identified by the tribe or region. This particular group is identified by their name of God. This pharaoh knew who Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh was, and this is the symbol for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in the Egyptian hieroglyphs. He knew who Joseph's not that long dead. This is before the latest, and it's before. So Israel is in Egypt as part of their society. But he's talking about another group that lives to the far east. That's what all this hieroglyph says. That lives to the far east of them that he subjugated, and they're the people, and their name is Shatsu of Yahweh, of Jehovah, the people of Jehovah. They were Bedouin, and that Shatsu is the term that was interchangeably used for the Bedouin Kenites. The Bedouin Kenites. Isn't that interesting? So The Egyptian archaeology is identifying the ancestors of, before he's born, of Jethro, saying that these guys live in, out there in the wilderness to the east, and we already showed you that they live in the east, in the area of Midian. These Kenites lived there. They were smiths, and they worship Jehovah. Fascinating. Not only that, but their smithing, go ahead to the next slide, their smithing practices were such that they would move in to whatever regions they could, where the bronze and copper and tin were, because they were mining the ore and making the metal products. And this is actually a repurposed temple to Hathor, and the people of the region kicked the Egyptians out. The Kenites moved in, and they built a, guess what? This is still pre-Exodus. They built a tabernacle. The Egyptians are eerily similar, and it had a holy place and a place for sacrifice, and it had a holy place. Isn't that interesting? This is pre-Exodus, by the way. So, back to my, I got to go back to my my notes here. I can wrap in 5 minutes. I don't want to, but I'm going to wrap in 5 minutes. I just need to figure out where I'm at. Go ahead. People of Israel, when they were in captivity, were pagan. Moses was pagan. Jethro was not. Jethro taught the people of Israel who God was, told Moses who God was, taught them how to worship, and then God in his Torah did the rest. There was always a remnant in the land. There's always a remnant preserved by God, and there is a remnant he's preserving right now. One of the things I would like to like you to consider going forward, because this is all part of that. What is the kingdom and what is the good news? You know, we're still fleshing that out. The Kenites were the remnant that were preserved back then. We have it in Scripture. I proved it to you through Scripture. And we have it from two completely different sources in archaeological finds. We can also see that the current Israel is as apostate as the one that was in Egypt. And God has to have a remnant in this world for his prophecy to be fulfilled. He's promised that he will bring his people back. And he's promised that once the fullness of the Gentiles come in, that all of the Jews will recognize their Messiah and repent. That's his promise. So, my question is, who's the remnant? I would like... like to think that we are. I pray that we are. I made the statement earlier. There are other texts outside of the canonical texts. Not all of them are good. And not all of them should be read. And not all of them should be followed in isolation. None of it should. But the Torah was written to reveal itself, both written and unwritten, in the conduct of which, how we worship and love our God. It wasn't to be a complete history. It's not even chronological. It's to serve its own purpose. I want us to live into the Torah that he has given us, so that we can be that remnant and be grafted into Israel, to his chosen people and receive his blessing and live with him in his good world forever. Shabbat Shalom.